You're listening to the GNU World Order, Episode 5 of Season 8. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order. This is a podcast where we talk about Linux and GNU and technical topics, and you get education and entertainment all wrapped into one hour-long show. Well, that's the theory anyway. In today's show, we're going to talk about Slackware 14. I'll give a little review of that. We'll talk about Slackware Ports, a new command line tool that interfaces with all of your Slack builds and helps you search through them and research them and read up on them and install them. And we'll talk about Flex Backup, a command line backup solution that I recently stumbled upon, and of course some listener feedback, mostly a bash tip. And let's get started. Okay, listener feedback. I didn't get that much listener feedback lately, but once again, I am recording this pretty early in the release cycle, so I'm kind of preempting, I'm sure, a lot of the feedback that is forthcoming. However, there was a little bit of a feedback from Gubnu, who you might know from HPR. He did a great show on NixOS, which I keep meaning to try myself and still have not. But anyway, Gubnu sent me a very cool little shell script that he wrote with functions and GUI elements. This is really interesting. I would read the whole thing for you, but I fear it would get a little bit, I don't know, there's a lot to it, so I don't think I'm going to do that, but it really is really quite nice. And the main, I think, takeaway from this, I mean, I'll paste the whole thing into the show notes so you'll be able to see it and even implement it if you want to. But one of the really nice things about it, at least for me, the thing that I learned from this, well, two things. One thing I didn't learn from it, but I feel like it's probably worth mentioning, and it's the time-honored while loop. And, of course, to do a while loop in Bash, you set some variable to zero, for instance, and then you say, while that variable is equal to zero, do these things. And then with each thing that you do, you increment that variable. Well, in that case, it would only be once. But you could also say that that the variable equals, I don't know, 10. And then while it's less than 10, do these things. And then after each iteration, you increment the variable. And the way to do that in Bash is with the let in plus plus is how you will increment a variable. So you might say, for instance, this is an upload script that Gubnu sent me. So if he's uploading files to a server, then you might say, okay, uploaded equals 10, while bracket dollar sign uploaded space dash le less than or equal to 10, close bracket, semicolon, do a bunch of stuff. And then at the end of the bunch of stuff, you would say, let uploaded plus plus. Now uploaded is set to whatever it was plus 1. It would loop back around to the while, take a look at uploaded, it's still less than 10, and then it would do a bunch of stuff, and then it would increment uploaded again, loop back around to the while, check uploaded out, and so on. So that's kind of a good thing to remember. It's a great trick for doing iterations of something. And you can test that out yourself without doing a fancy loop. You can just do, like, in Bash, if you open up a terminal, in equals 1, echo dollar sign in, you get 1 back. Then let space in plus plus, now echo dollar sign in, and sure enough, you get back 2. So it does work. And the way to leverage it is inside of a while loop, and you'll get that same result. Thought I should mention it, since I don't think we've really mentioned it that much on this show. So that exists, while loops. But what I really, really learned about, which is really, really cool, or at least interesting, is kdialog. Sounds simple enough, but the cool thing about kdialog, which is like the KDE version of qdialog, is that kdialog can be manipulated from the command line, meaning that if you do something like kdialog space dash dash message box msgbox space quote hello world close quote, and then hit return, sure enough, you get a GUI message box that says, Hello World, with an OK button on it. Do you want more than that? Well, you can have more than that. You can do, for instance, kdialogue space dash dash yes no space quote hello world end quote. Now you get a message box in your GUI that says hello world and either a yes or a no. Obviously it's very cool, but how do you leverage it? Well, GubNews script leverages it quite deftly, and again you can look at his code and it's a little bit confusing, especially to hear me say it, because he uses the same appearing to us humans, it looks practically the same, but he's got two variables, file name all in caps and file name all in lowercase. So in the upload function, he's got file name all capitals equals dollar sign parentheses kdialog space dash dash input box space file name all lowercase close parentheses. He's assigning the contents of capital file name to the results of user input into kdialog. Obviously, that's a great way, or a very cool way, to get to make interactive scripts. Now, when I first saw the script and saw these cool little dialog boxes popping up everywhere, I thought it was really, really neat, because I thought, wow, this is amazing. He's got this interactive thing happening, and it almost seems like a real program, you know, like a GUI program. And then I kind of thought about it for a while and thought, wow, how horrible that is. I mean, isn't one of the advantages of a shell script that you don't have to have a GUI, like you can run it from anywhere and all this other stuff? So on one hand, while I think, oh, that's really, really cool, on the other hand, I think, wow, I would never use that. But the fact is, that's not true. I might use that. I might very well use that, because what if I had a friend who was using this and they wanted some easy way to do something that there wasn't an easy way to do? I could write a shell script with my limited programming skills for this person, but have it have all these nice, fancy, GUI dialogue things. And you could tie this to some kind of .desktop file, so, you know, they could literally have, like, a file uploader, for instance, that appears in their application menu that they click on, and then suddenly it just pops up a little dialogue box that asks them for a file, and then it uploads everything to this place that you need them to upload it to. You know, and you've just made, like, some process a lot simpler and a lot more, I guess, quote unquote, user friendly. I should say dumbing it down. You've dumbed it down for your user sufficiently so that, you know, it feels like they can handle it. So very, very cool, and it really exemplifies the flexibility of Linux, the amazing kind of low bar, or the low entry, the low barrier of entry, you know, that people who can't even really program can do stuff like this and leverage their GUI in such an interactive way. I think it's amazing. And yes, I do know that there is Zenity for GTK, so you can check that out as well. I just thought it was kind of cool that KDialog exists within KDE without any, you know, you don't have to install anything extra. It happens to be there. Never knew about it. That's very cool. Do try that out if you've got the need for interactive GUI shell script things. So thank you very much, GubNew, for that shell script, and that's about it for listener feedback. Let's get into Slackware. Slackware 14 has been out now for about a month and a couple of weeks, maybe. I only just installed it because I was really just waiting for the physical disk media, and I never mind waiting a month or two after Slackware gets released, because it gives every website a chance to kind of catch up, you know, especially slackbuilds.org, which is sort of the main, most popular repository of Slack build scripts, so that you can quickly and easily install new applications. Compile and install new applications. So I just did the upgrade about 2 weeks ago from this recording, 3 weeks by the time you hear it, and it went really, really well. I did two upgrades, one for my main desktop and one for my main laptop. Well, my only desktop and my main laptop. And it just went perfect. I didn't choose to do an upgrade from current, which I have done in the past. I think it was from 12 to 12.1 to 13, possibly. Or it might have been 13 to 13.37. I don't think it was. But anyway, I just did a complete reinstall. And the upgrade just, it was just beautiful. Both of them were to SSD drives. I've got an SSD drive now in both my desktop and my laptop. So they were both to an SSD drive, meaning that they were super, super fast. And then I simply pointed the new user that I created to my home directory, to the home partition on my desktop, and it just, everything was back to normal. I did a full reinstall of all the application sets, of course, because I wasn't upgrading. And it was great. It was fantastic. It went so smoothly that I really kind of felt, I mean, I felt great. You know, it just felt exactly like what an operating system upgrade was supposed to feel like. There was one catch on the desktop that I might as well mention. It was my fault, but it's still kind of, it was quirky enough, I think, to deserve at least a little bit of a mention. So I decided to upgrade the data storage drive that I have in the desktop, or one of the data storage drives. And I thought, well, I should just assign /var to this new drive so that it, cause I think I only gave myself something like, I want to say 10, maybe 20 gigabytes for my /var originally. And that was fine. I mean, on my 13.37 install. That was fine because I'm not hosting any websites or really doing anything with var other than using it as a /var partition. So log files and Slack builds and things like that. Not really that big of a deal. But I felt like I might as well give myself a little bit more space just in case I want to start playing around more in what would traditionally be in /var. So I reassigned that to this partition of this new drive that I was installing into the desktop. Well, turns out I used a drive that either had a foreign partition map or that had been incorrectly formatted. I'm not really sure what I did wrong, unfortunately, exactly. I have a feeling it's the partition map, but it seemed to be fine, the drive. And so I had it in the desktop. I was doing the install, and I pointed the installer to this partition for /var, and I installed. It went through the whole install process, didn't throw any errors, at least enough to make me think that I should check any kind of log or anything. You know, it didn't flash anything on screen like, hey, this is bad. It just kind of did the whole install. So I reboot, and interestingly, everything sort of, it seemed fine at first, so much so that I went ahead and did normal activities like installing applications, creating a user, things like that. Turns out all this time there was no /var. It couldn't read from the /var, or maybe it couldn't write. I don't exactly remember now. But there was an issue with /var. But everything was working, at least on the surface. Finally, I start doing a couple of fairly normal tasks. I don't remember exactly what. Sort of like things like going in and installing extra software and having to kind of see, did I have this software installed yet? So I would do like a list in log, in var log packages to see if I'd installed something, and it wouldn't be there. So I thought, well, okay, I'll just reinstall that, I guess, because I thought I'd installed it, but maybe I was just getting confused, so I would install it again. And then I would do other things, like try to install something with some special flags, and it would fail. Just really bizarre, quirky things that I couldn't figure out. Finally, I started figuring out that /var was not actually in existence. I mean, I thought it was, and it seems like it was, but it clearly was not being, it was not acting like it should act. So I finally narrowed it down to /var not really being a partition, and I narrowed that down to the way that I had incorrectly partitioned it initially. By that time, I was so thoroughly confused as to what I'd done to my system that I just did a full reinstall because I was kind of nervous about, you know, getting started on the wrong foot, sort of, like maybe I'd reinstalled stuff that I shouldn't have reinstalled. And so I just did a full reinstall. But before doing that, I went back out into G-parted, or parted rather, is what it's called, and redid the partition map on this new hard drive, which I'm pretty sure that was the issue. The important thing here to note is that when you're adding stuff to FS tab, I'm not 100% sure, at least in the Slackware installer, that it's really doing any kind of verification as to whether it can find that partition. So you have to be mindful of that. Make sure that you've partitioned your drives correctly, that they're all using a known partition format, and then install your system. Because I'm pretty sure I was using a GUID partition scheme, but I was assuming I was using an MBR or whatever it's called, a DOS or DOS table, whatever, and I was not. So that kind of screwed me up the first run through on my desktop. That was a problem for me. So be aware of that, that you could do possibly an install and rob yourself out of an important system directory like /var, and the thing will still boot and it will still act as if though it's perfectly normal until you start running programs that absolutely rely upon /var. Oh, and for the record, I checked dmessage, and yeah, it did warn me that /var was not found and everything, but it was something that, you know, if you're not reading the boot up screen and you start your computer and you maybe even start X, everything seems to work correctly, you might not notice it right away. Actually, that's not true. One thing didn't work correctly, and that was ConsoleKit, ConsoleKit. When I started X, I started the login to my desktop, it did give me a warning about ConsoleKit. I still don't even know what ConsoleKit is or was, so I just kind of clicked OK to see if that was like I don't know how to migrate your current KDE to your new KDE. You know, I wasn't really sure what that was telling me. I ignored it, kept it in mind, and then things started going, not wrong, but weird, and then I decided that those errors were probably substantial. Then I checked dmessage, saw that /var was having problems, and sort of narrowed it down that way. So, other than that, everything went fine. And again, I think it's kind of my fault for partitioning the thing wrong in the first place and not really verifying that it was correctly done. So the install process was a pleasure. I really, really love the simple install that Slackware gives you. Slackware 14 as a package. I mean, really, I was toying around with a review that lasted all of 30 seconds, because really, if you were to review Slackware, it's basically just like, it's still Slackware. It's the same as it has ever been, in the best of ways. It's really hard to kind of review Slackware. It's not like they do a whole lot other than throw some packages together into an easy-to-install collection, so there's not really much to it. It does use the Network Manager, or I should say it includes the option to use Network Manager. I haven't actually used it that much. I do have it ready to go on my laptop, although lately this laptop being on its last legs as it is, I haven't really taken it out as much as I used to, so I haven't really needed to do fancy networking things like signing onto a wireless network. I just kind of plug it into the wired connection here and start it up, and it gets the DHCP connection just as part of the RC.inet startup process. The Network Manager seems to be pretty good. I've used it a little bit here and there. Seems nice enough. I mean, if you've ever used Network Manager on any other distribution, it's sort of the same thing. You know, it's kind of a nice little convenient daemon that kind of runs in the background waiting for DHCP to change or waiting for you to plug in a new connection, something like that. There's a very nice new network interface for KDE 4.8. Whatever this is using. It's completely integrated. It's quite nice. On the previous 13.37 install, I had actually installed from Alien Bob's binary stash a more recent version of KDE than my desktop had. So the desktop was running 13.37 and 4.5. I had my laptop on something like 4.6 maybe, or 4.7. So I was ahead of the game on the laptop for a little while anyway, and I discovered this nice KDE Wicked front end that made it look and feel a lot more integrated than the normal Python GUI Wicked that you're probably used to if you're a Wicked user. Well, now KDE 4.8 has a proper network managing tool that you can put into your little system tray thing, and it's completely integrated, and it's quite functional, and it's quite nice. I've been using it for quite a while now, and it's good. That's been nice. Let's see what else has changed in 14. Not a whole heck of a lot, to be honest. It's really just a lot of the more, you know, more of the same, and that's exactly the way I think most of us like it. So if you haven't tried Slackware 14 or Slackware at all, you might want to give it a shot. It's really nice. Someone in IRC today was talking to me about Salix OS, S-A-L-I-X OS, and that, of course, is a Slackware-based distribution. Don't know much about it, but I do know that it has, like, a nice GUI package manager and stuff like that. So you could always try that as well if you wanted to get into the Slackware ecosphere, but not completely into Slackware. Of course, I haven't really tried Salix myself all that much. I think I might have booted into it once for kicks, but Slackware is kind of good enough for me. But yeah, it's a great system. It's very nice, very Unixy. It feels very Unixy. It keeps everything simple, very human readable, very adjustable, and it's a good system. Very stable, and they only release once a year or once a year and a half. That's kind of nice too. So check it out. Well, it's time for coffee, so let's go get some coffee together, more or less, separately. And then we'll come back and have a little bit more of a discussion about Slackware and BSD ports and Slack builds. And, heck, we'll throw in some Plan 9 stuff, too. No, seriously, Plan 9. I wanted to talk a little bit about a new application that I myself developed as a front-end to a collection of Slack builds. It models itself entirely after the BSD port system, which I'll talk about in a moment to clarify what I mean by that, and it is a command line interface that will help you search, research, download, build, and install from a collection of Slack builds. To give you a little bit of history as to why I felt this was necessary, there was a mailing list discussion on the slackbuild.org users mailing list. And someone had asked, wouldn't it be nice if we could have an official way of listing dependencies that are required for a certain application? So, as an example, Audacity requires WXPython in order to build. It won't build if you don't have WXPython. It recommends TuLame and SoundTouch. In the past, on slackbuilds.org, which is basically just the largest and most uniform collection of Slack builds out there, definitely not the only one, but it exists and it's a good thing to kind of base a lot of expectation on because it's so popular. Previously on slackbuilds.org, in their collection of Slack builds, the dependencies for a package, whether they were optional or required, were listed in the README file. And so someone on the mailing list was saying, why don't we have a field in the, for instance, audacity.info file, in the Slack build, why don't we have a field in that file that says it requires WXPython? Now, a lot of people on the mailing list kind of saw where that was going, and it doesn't take a genius to see where it's going. Obviously, someone wants to write some kind of application that will automatically resolve required dependencies, right? Why else would you ask for a standardized field for required dependencies? And so that caused a little bit of controversy, because if you mention that to a bunch of Slackware users, there's bound to be controversy. And I myself, I kind of sniffed that out pretty quickly as well. And my immediate response was, oh brother, here we go again. But, I mean, really, it doesn't matter to me. I'm not going to use an application that automatically tries to resolve dependencies. That's just not what I'm interested in. If I was, I wouldn't be using Slackware. So it didn't really matter to me. And I thought, well, if someone out there wants us to do it that way, I don't see why that would be such a big deal. I mean, I don't care in my own Slack build scripts. I don't care how I list my dependencies. I can do it in some standardized way if that would help someone. It just didn't seem like that big of a deal to me. And it didn't seem like that big of a deal to a lot of people. And so there was kind of a discussion. It was actually remarkably civil, considering the controversial subject it was kind of touching on. In the end, someone decided that they would place the required dependencies in a foo.info file, which already existed. It lists things like the download link and the MD5 sum and stuff like that. So now it has the required dependencies listed in the foo.info, and in the README file, the optional dependencies and the build options are listed as they have always been. And that seemed like a pretty good compromise to me, and I think to a lot of other people, it didn't really seem like a bad idea. In practice, however, as I've learned, now that I've done a full Slackware 14 install twice, in practice, this really has disturbed my workflow, and I have to admit, I'm really surprised by it, and it's my own fault, because I totally voted for it, or, you know, I agreed to play by whatever rules everyone else decided upon, and I didn't really think of this being an issue, and it kind of surprised me that it was an issue, but what has been happening is that I'll be installing an application from a Slack build. And whereas before, it was a matter of looking at the README file, confirming that I have everything that I need installed, and then installing the application, or installing the dependencies and then installing the application, now I have to look at a Slack build, I have to look at the .info file to see the required dependencies, and I go through all that. Then I have to read the README to see if there are any other optional dependencies, and I have to go through all those. And then I have to read the README file again for any build options. It's really slowed me down, actually, because I feel like I keep having to go back and forth between two different files, whereas before it was like one file every time. It was that one file. And now it's like, always check the info file, always check the info file, always check the info file. So it really kind of upset my, and I don't mean emotionally upset, I mean, it threw me off. It became something that the normal routine that I followed when installing things was disturbed. And I lived through it for a little while, and then I finally thought, okay, this is crazy. And I was using SBOPKG to install a bunch of stuff, and I do a lot of it from the command line without the little SBOPKG incurses GUI. You just do SBOPKG-I, name of package. So I was doing that, and I kept having to cat foo.info and foo README or README whatever for foo, and it was really slowing me down. So I thought, you know what, this is stupid. Let me just create a quick alias to something that, or a little program that will look by default, that will cat by default both the .info file and the README file on one screen, and that way I have all the information I need on one screen, and that would just speed things up for me. So I did that, and once I had done that, I thought, wow, this is really nice. I have everything on one screen. Now I could conceivably use SBOPKG-I to install the stuff that's listed on that screen. And it became kind of this going back and forth between the little cat alias I'd made myself and SBOPKG, and they weren't really working that well together. And I thought, you know, now that I've got this thing configured so that it cats a packages, README and info file, why not just add something that will also install the thing? And so I started kind of adding a couple of features, and then a couple more features, and then a couple more features. And now I've got something that I call Sport, or S-Port, or Slackware Port, and that is modeled completely after BSD ports, as I've said. And if you've never used BSD port, then you have no idea what that means. My friend Monster B was, who you'll know from Linux Cranks, for instance, and Tit Radio, and a couple of other things. He got me kind of turned on about BSD, and I used it for a good year. I mean, I talked about it, I think, on the end of season 5 or the end of season 6. I did a big BSD episode. So, you know, I had it like on a laptop for a solid year, and I really did enjoy it. And one of the things that I enjoyed, I think, was the manual hands-on experience of this port collection. So now, FreeBSD has this great handbook that they put together, and you can find out nearly everything you ever want to know about anything BSD in that handbook. And so I went back to it and kind of read up again on BSD ports, and I remembered exactly pretty much how it was, but I'm going to review it right now for you, since you possibly have never used BSD ports. But when you install BSD, one of the things that you can do during install is grab the BSD port tree. And if you don't do that during install, then you can use a little tool called Port Snap. And Port Snap, basically, I mean, I gather, I haven't actually looked at it, I think technically it's a front end that uses fetch to get this a copy of all the BSD ports. I could be wrong, though. It might just be rsync. But it pulls down a copy of all the scripts that would be involved to quickly and easily compile and install a bunch of applications. So once you have that tree of all these applications downloaded onto your computer, it goes into /usr/ports. Then you can go into /usr/ports, just cd right over there, cd/usr/ports, and then for instance /sysutils/lsof, if that was the application that you wanted to install. Once you're inside the lsof directory, you can see the port skeleton, and it has all the required scripts and files that would that it would take to successfully compile lsof, and you simply do a make, and that will make that port. Then you do a make install, that installs it, and then you can do a make clean. And if you're in a hurry, you can just do make install clean, and that does all three things all at once. And that's it. That's the port collection. Now, ports are unique in that they use make files, obviously, to complete their task, and they also resolve dependencies. Aside from the dependency thing, it's almost not even worthy of a special name, you know. It's just a collection of makefiles. That's all it is. So there's nothing mysterious to BSD ports. It's really very standard stuff, and of course that's one of the reasons a lot of people like it, because it is. It's very human readable. It's low barrier of entry. If you know how to make a makefile, write a makefile, then you can conceivably do a port file. I've done a port before, a couple of ports. It's just not that hard to generate one yourself. I mean, obviously it can get complex when you start doing really fancy applications with lots of dependencies and things like that. But overall, conceptually, it's easy to get started with BSD ports. And amazingly, it's that simple for Slackware, Slack builds as well. So they're very, very similar systems. The difference would be that Slack builds do not use makefiles. They are shell scripts that then execute make commands and a couple of other, like a make pkg and an install pkg command. And they don't do dependencies. So in that sense, they're even simpler than BSD ports. But that was what I wanted to emulate. The act of changing directory into the directory that contains this build file, and then making it and installing it from that directory, and kind of, you know, crawling through the building, the tree of all these scripts, and kind of exploring that way. That was something that appealed to me, and I wanted to be able to do that and get everything done with this one system. I didn't want to have to do a cat or a gunzip of the Slack build itself, and then cat the readme and the info separately, and then download the source from the link in the info file, and then build it, and then install it. That's a lot of commands from a lot of different places. I kind of wanted one command that would execute the most logical groups of those commands together. Whether that's an improvement or not, I don't know. I mean, it differs from person to person, but that is what I wanted to emulate. That feel of the BSD port process, I wanted that in this new system that I was building. And I think that's more or less what I have. So the first step that you would do, well, you'd first have to be running Slackware to try this at all, but assuming you are, or assuming that you can pretend like you are for the next couple of minutes, you would first rsync a Slack build collection from some place. Technically, Sport could work with pretty much any collection of Slack builds, but it does kind of model itself after the slackbuilds.org collection, simply because, like I say, that's the big, most uniform one that I know of, so that's kind of, and it's the one that I'm used to, and the one that I contribute to, so that's the one that I built it around. I think if you were going to do it with some other collection that wasn't, that didn't use categories, then you might run into some problems. But Slack builds does, just like ports does. So it fits really, really well. So there's a link literally on the slackbuilds.org page. There's an rsync link so that you can literally rsync the entire thing from the command line. You can just rsync their entire repository right to your computer. You can also use FTP, Git, HTTP, lots of different ways to look at their repository. But certainly one of the, I think, most efficient ways is rsync. So you would do that. You would do an rsync of their repository to some location on your hard drive. SBOPKG, which a lot of Slackware users are going to be using anyway, dumps it into /var/lib/sbopkg/sbo/14.0. Right now. Next version, I'm sure it'll be 15.0 or whatever. But yeah, that's where it puts it. So that's kind of the default that I fall back on. But you could just as soon put it in /usr/sbo or something like that. You know, you could put it anywhere. So once you have a copy of all of the available Slack build scripts on your hard drive, you now have a local mirror of that repository. And you can now treat it pretty much exactly like you would treat USB port system. Now, just like, for instance, BSD ports as well as SBOPKG, this is a package installer-related command, so it's root executable only. And so it goes into /usr/sbin, the sport script itself, I mean. Now, you can install it. I wrote a Slack build for it, so you could actually install it from the Slack build. But you can also install it manually simply by copying the sport script to /usr/sbin, and then the man page to /usr/man/man8, and the info page to /usr/info. Simple enough. Then you're all installed. Otherwise, you could just do it with Slack build, or the Slack build that I included. Now, sport requires you to set one thing as part of the setup, and that is the SBO path. So if you're doing an SBOPKG style install where you have everything in /var/lib/sbopkg/sbo/14.0, then you would add that to the script. And the variable for that is SBO path. And that's the default. That's what it's set by default. But if you were putting it somewhere else, like /usr/sbo, for instance, then you'd want to set that as your SBO path. So everything from within the sport command is relative to that path, which I think makes pretty good sense. So you've got this local mirror, you've defined the location of the mirror in SBO, in sport, and now you can use sport as you would, a lot like you would a BSD port system. So, for instance, the first thing that you might do in your BSD ports is search for a package. So let's say you were looking for W3M. You might change directory into USR ports, and then you might do a make space search equals W3M. And that will do a search through your port collection for a string that matches W3M. I could be a little bit wrong on that command. It could be a little bit slightly different, but if I'm recalling correctly, that's the command. It's make space search equals and then some string. You could also just do the old school ls space asterisk slash asterisk W3M asterisk. So you're just doing a super fuzzy search, a super fuzzy list in any subdirectory in the ports collection of anything that contains the string W3M. And that's actually the way I wrote the list function in sport first was that. That proved not to be very flexible, so I ended up using find. But either way, you're searching your Slack build collection for W3M. And it would return network/emacs-w3m.tar.gz and network/w3m.tar.gz. So there's two results there. So if you wanted to install W3M, then the first thing that you would do, at least for a Slack build, now again, you wouldn't really do this on ports because ports resolves all your dependencies. So you would just do a make, or you would cd into that directory and then just do a make. But in Slack builds, you don't have the dependency resolution. So you need to investigate and find out what you need to install before you go trying to install W3M. And this is, of course, the reason that I wrote the thing in the first place. And that would be sport space cat space network /W3M. Okay, so you're in your port in your Slack build collection, but you need to define which W3M you're talking about. So that's why you have to give the category. It's a little bit flexible. You could do a sport cat net asterisk slash W3M if you were lazy and didn't want to type out the whole category. But otherwise, you have to kind of point it at the right W3M. But you do a sport cat network slash W3M, and then it cats the info file, which tells you all kinds of interesting things, including most especially the requires line, which is the required dependencies, and also the full contents of the README file, which is the place that would tell you if there are any special build options or any recommended dependencies. And that was the reason that I did all of this anyway, for that one function there. And that's quite handy. And in the case of W3M, you would see that it requires GC, which is a garbage collection, I think, and imlib too. I don't know what that is. So you would then have to kind of step away from W3M, do a sport search GC, and you would find that, and you would go and install that, and then you'd do a search for imlib, and you'd install that, and then you'd come back to W3M. But let's just pretend like we have GC and imlib2 already installed. So the next logical step, I guess, would be to check to see if you have W3M installed. Obviously, you could do that really easily with which W3M something or something like that, but I just went ahead and did a sport check W3M or whatever, imlib2, whatever you're checking on. So a sport check will look in var log packages to see if you've ever installed that package before. Just kind of a dummy check to make sure that you're not about to go install something again. It's really more of a convenience function. It doesn't really do a whole lot since there are so many other ways to do that, but I just thought it might be smart to just kind of provide that function in there. So once you're sure that you really want to install this thing, then you can do two things. You can either do the equivalent of a make or the equivalent of a make install. So that would be sport build network slash W3M, or if you cd into network, you can do a sport build dot slash W3M, and that does most everything for you. It looks at the info file, grabs out the link to the home page, to the source code, and it wgets the source code, and then it executes the Slack build without executing the install pkg script or command. So it builds it and it dumps your installable file into slash temp. That's where Slack builds always dump your installable file. And then you would manually do install pkg space slash tmp slash w3m txz, whatever. You can also combine that. You just do a sport install, so that would be like doing a make install on BSD ports. Sport install network slash w3m, and it does everything. It downloads, builds, and then installs. You can also do a sport clean, which cleans up after itself and kind of ditches the source code and stuff like that. So if you're worried about disk space, there's that function. And the nice thing about it, of course, is that it's all command line, so it's just normal bash stuff. So if you want to pass arguments to the Slack build script, you can do so as normal. So for instance, if you're building Audacity and want to make sure that two lame options are included in the configure step, then you could do two lame equals yes, and then sport install network slash audio slash Audacity, and that would install Audacity, passing on the variable tolame equals yes to the Slack build, which will then use it when it's configuring and making the Audacity application. You can also pass make options, which Cobra 2 helped me with, and that is simply make opts, all capitals, make opts equals quote dash J8, close quote, sport install audio Audacity, or whatever it is, multimedia Audacity, whatever it is, and that would pass the make opts flag to your make command, so it's using all 8 cores while it's building the application, which would obviously speed it up a lot. And that's really it. That's the command, and it's really it works really well. I really hadn't expected it to be so, I guess, addictive, but it has turned out to be very addictive for me, because it really is. It gives you that same feel of, oh boy, I'm crawling through my port tree, as it were, or my Slack build tree, and I'm looking at applications and I'm installing them like I'm used to installing more or less applications on a command line, i.e. /configure make install, but I'm doing it with this other command that's close enough and it still gives you the same feel, and it's all traceable and trackable, and you can see what's been installed, and you can update things, and you can remove packages easily, you know, the whole advantage of doing things with a Slack build versus just pure source code compiling without any record of it having been done. So if you are interested in using Sport, Slackware ports, for your own Slackware install, please do feel free to go check it out at slackermedia.info/sport. And you can find the downloadable files on Gatorius. There's a link from it, obviously, on the page, but you can also just go straight to Gatorius if you want. Gatorius.org/slackport. That will get you all the Sport files as they are updated in Git. It's been about a week, maybe 2 weeks of development, really. I mean, solving problems, reversing bad choices, cleaning up code, all that other good stuff. But I feel like it's pretty solid at this point. I've been using it really exclusively for my Slack build interface since I wrote it. Would I do a lot of compiling like this? Probably not. Like, the SBOPKG ability to do Q files, for instance, is just brilliant. It's not to be beat, right? So if for Slacker Media, where you're the one of the first steps is to compile a bunch of dependencies and libraries, I wouldn't want to do that with Sport, because you'd have to do that by hand, and that would be insane. I would do that with SBOPKG, with a Q file. But all the stuff that you kind of think later on, you know, you're like, oh, I should install this cool-sounding synthesizer, but I didn't really think to install it initially. Let me just go over to the Slack build tree and build it myself. Those little one-off, two-off, ten-off kinds of installs you can do very easily with Sport. And I mean, one of the most rigorous tests for Sport that I did was the Miro application, which is the pod-catching, video-cast-catching multimedia player. And it requires a bunch of stuff, like GNOME things that I you just wouldn't normally install, WebKit stuff, you know, lots of things that just don't come on a default Slackware install. So there's a lot of dependencies, because you look at Miro and it's got all these dependencies, and then you look at those dependencies and it's got dependencies. But I installed that with Sport, and it just went really, really well. It felt so fast to me, because you can cat everything on one screen, you can look, kind of just eyeball the dependencies, you can cat those dependencies, and then just kind of start from the end and build your way back to the beginning and install Miro at the end or at the beginning, whatever. So it seems really, really efficient to me, and somehow it just felt faster than navigating SBOPKG's incurses interface. That having been said, I'm pretty sure that SBOPKG as a command line tool is a lot more flexible, and I just haven't actually learned all of the tricks that SBOPKG has to offer. So I don't believe that Sport is by any means a replacement for SBOPKG. I think it's quite good, SBOPKG. But if you want something a little bit different, you might want to look at Sport. And anyway, I had fun writing it. It's a cool shell script now, and it does a lot of new things that I haven't ever done before. And I'm enjoying it. So if you want to check it out, please do so. I stumbled across an interesting project from some article. I forget where I read it, but it was the fact that, of course, Plan 9 exists. We know this. We've heard of it. It's the sort of famous/infamous replacement for Unix from, I think, Bell Labs. So it was kind of, it was going to be the successor to Unix. When you hear that it's going to take the place of Unix, that's, or that it was intended to do that, that is kind of interesting if you're interested in Unix. So I decided to take a look at it, and some time ago there was a Linux Format, and this is quite a while ago now, Linux Format magazine that actually shipped with a version of Plan 9, and I think I may have tried to run it in a virtual machine and it failed. I can't remember right now, but I do remember it didn't get very far. It could have just been I ran it and then got bored very, very quickly, but either way, it didn't leave much of an impression on me, and lately I found out that there's a fork of Plan 9 called 9front. So if you go to cat-v, as in Victor, .org, you will find the cat-v group. I don't really know what they're calling themselves these days, but it's a collective of people who are doing some stuff online. And It's interesting. They've literally forked. Well, they've done a few things for Plan 9, actually. One is that they have forked it into something called 9front, and then they've also they maintain a series of patches that are not a fork, and they sit on top of, or they are designed to sit on top of Plan 9 stock, Plan 9, and patch it up so that it works with more modern hardware and doesn't break quite as often, things like that. I opted to try 9front because it seemed like the much easier way to go. So you can download an ISO of 9front, and the hardware support for it is much greater than Plan 9, although I can't say it's super great, but certainly in a QEMU virtual machine, it works pretty much as you would expect. I was having trouble with actually seeing my mouse cursor, but other than that, it does boot into a little graphical interface, very minimal, and it does give you a command line, a BusyBox, actually, command line. So it's, I mean, I don't know, I've never been a huge fan of BusyBox. I mean, it's great that it exists, it sounds really neat, and I guess it does provide a command line on things that otherwise might not have a command line. But in terms of like a full-featured shell, BusyBox doesn't usually strike me as super featureful. But it is there, and you do have a command line, and you can do different things like ls/bin, and you can run a couple of different programs, and you can look at a lot of the code in there. So it's really an interesting diversion. I can't say that it's anything that you can really spend a whole lot of time in, at least not if you're on my level of spending time on things, but it's active. I mean, if you go to 9times, that is 9 spelled out, N-I-N-E, times.cat-v.org, they've got kind of a, I guess, a running newsletter or a change log for 9front. So, and I think it also has news for Plan 9 itself and a couple of other things. So there's, you know, there are commits from like 10/25, 2012. So it's very, very, I guess, current. In fact, they've just had a new release called Sandybox, which fixes a bug in the VESA graphics, or VESA, however you say that, V-E-S-A graphics initialization in VirtualBox. So if you're trying it in VirtualBox, I guess it wouldn't have worked, but now it will. So, I don't know. It's interesting to look at. It's interesting to see, I guess, what might have been, or not really. I mean, it doesn't seem that nostalgic. It's just interesting, that's all. So if you're at all fascinated with other Unixes, then yeah, there's this. There's 9front, the update fork of Plan 9. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Experimenters in visual perception are using computers to create weird, random patterns.